From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we dive into the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Then our Fit for You segment explores why you may be having trouble sleeping or experiencing odd dreams in quarantine.
There's also just the really big issue of stress and anxiety, and certainly how we feel and our level of stress can pretty significantly impact how we sleep at night and how we perceive the quality of our sleep.
Plus how Gothic Milwaukee's historical ghost tours are managing the pandemic and how previous pandemics led to their own ghostly tales.
There was a tremendous loss of life due to that, and when people are taken from their life very suddenly, that's usually where you get ghost stories.
Plus, we feature an essay that pays tribute to comedy legends Jerry Stiller and Fred Willard. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled last week that the Trump administration cannot immediately end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, more commonly known as DACA. The Obama-era program protects 700,000 young immigrants who were brought to the United States as children from deportation. The program gives qualified children temporary legal status if they graduate from high school, are honorably discharged from the military, and if they pass a background check. In 2017, the Trump administration declared the program was over, only to be blocked by lower courts and now the Supreme Court. Chief Justice John Roberts sided with the four liberals on the court in a 5-4 vote last week. But the decision does not mean the fight over DACA is done. For a more in-depth look at the decision, WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar spoke with Laura Fernandez, an immigration attorney in Milwaukee.
You mentioned that this decision was long awaited. Can you just give us a little bit of context, like how long has this decision been anticipated?
We've been expecting this decision since November 2019, which is when the actual arguments were in front of the Supreme Court. So, and it's pretty typical that major decisions from the Supreme Court's drop in June. So everyone was expecting this decision not to come until June. And, it, you know, for the last few weeks, it's like, is it going to be Monday? Is it going to be Thursday? Is it going to be next Monday? Is it going to be... So this is typical of people wait, you know, this is normal that we're expecting these things, big decisions in June.
Let's talk about the actual decision itself. I think that there was a lot of hype or maybe misunderstanding that this is the Supreme Court saving DACA, defending DACA. DACA is safe now. Please distill what is the decision that came down.
Okay, so this is not a decision about the legality of DACA. It is not a decision saying that the program was properly put into place or is legal or anything like that. This decision is really about the five justices in the majority finding that the government did not properly rescind the program because they didn't provide a basis that they found sufficient or detailed enough or properly stated, and essentially that leads them to find that the termination of the program was arbitrary and capricious.
When you first read this, what was your reaction?
My first reaction was to be completely surprised and want to fall out of my chair that it was happening, and second, that the person who wrote the majority decision was Justice Roberts, because frankly, we did not expect this to be a positive decision. We really expected this to be a negative decision, just because the expectation was that Roberts and the other four conservative justices were going to basically say that there was nothing wrong with Trump's ending of the program. But then, you know, reading through it, it's boring. It's about rulemaking cases. It's about this Administrative Procedures Act. It's, for me, it's sort of a bad flashback to law school and things that I don't have to deal with in my daily life because I do immigration law and it's very different kind of law.
What is the reaction of the Trump administration?
You know, immigration matters go through are operated through the Department of Homeland Security and more specifically an agency called U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, and that's who, as an immigration lawyer, that's who we're, you know, dealing with and submitting applications to and whatnot. So, I mean, they actually issued a statement yesterday that basically says that, well, I can read it. The Supreme Court's decision is an affront to the rule of law and give presidents power to extend discretionary policies into future administrations. No justice will say that the DACA program is lawful, and that should be reason enough to end it. And this is posted on the USCIS website. And yeah, it's just straight up says that they did not like this decision. You know, people submit applications to obtain immigration benefits from this agency. It is not a political organization, and it is very unusual for them to post this sort of straight up opinion statement on their website. At least I find it very surprising.
Laura, I know this is like nitty gritty stuff, getting really in the weeds, but I did want to ask you, because I know you took the time to read the dissenting opinions. I know you did your homework. So just give me like your quick take on what these dissenting opinions are. What was it that the justices were trying to say in their opinions?
So the dissents are basically saying that that is ridiculous to suggest that the government has to address any sort of reliance interest or like justify their decision in that way, because essentially it can be terminated by the executive branch and they don't need to go into that. So they are essentially saying that, I mean, the dissents are essentially discussing the ways that the administration should have the power to do what they want in this case.
Laura, I want to thank you so much for breaking down the dissenting opinions, because it also helps listeners understand and contextualize just how the decision was made, right? This wasn't a landslide decision where you had all of the justices on the same side. No, you actually have four justices who believe and who state publicly in their opinion that the administration was well within its rights to end this program.
I mean, this is a very close decision, and like, had Roberts gone the other way, it would have gone the other way. It really turns on Roberts, and I mean, this is why it's a surprise, because of course, it turns on Roberts siding with the liberal members of the court, and it's definitely a close decision, and it ended up turning on this minutia of administrative law ultimately. Now, whether there's some other motivation and whether there's like sort of like politics involved, not politics per se, but whether there was an issue of not wanting to come down against Dreamers on Roberts' end, or to make this kind of what would be considered a very unpopular result, is another issue that we don't know, right? Because we don't know what's in their minds. This decision doesn't address that. That's not how the Supreme Court works. They're making a decision based on rules and laws and again, minutia. But I mean, is it possible that that played a role in this? I mean, sure. You know, these are huge. This is like for Justice Roberts, this is a huge decision. It's going to have a huge impact, not only on people and, you know, people that live in America and immigrant issues and all this sort of things. And also, you know, it's something that is just obviously a hot topic, and it comes into the election and the, you know, just the Trump rhetoric and all of these things. So, I mean, we can't speculate, of course, on like whether that plays a role in his decision on this case. But I mean, it's something that's obviously being discussed.
Laura, I want to ask you about legislative action, because I was talking to a couple of Dreamers yesterday, and one thing that really surprised me was that I didn't know is that a bill passed in the House of Representatives. It turns out that that bill that would provide more clarity, more security for DACA recipients is just sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk.
So last year in June 2019, the House did pass a bill that would provide a path to citizenship for, generally speaking, the DACA population. It's some version of that. But yes, and so that bill has been sitting there without being taken up by the Senate for a year now. And this is not surprising per se, because the House, of course, is has a majority, you know, a Democrat majority since 2018, and the Senate with a Republican majority is just unwilling to basically entertain any immigration bill that until they supposedly have the level of enforcement that they want. Also, this has been the situation for years and years now, is that these bills come up and maybe one, you know, body will pass the bill depending on who's in the majority at that time, and then the other one will say, well, we need these, this and this things to, in order to bring this to even a debate or anything like that. And they want to trade. They want to trade for DACA or for a DREAM Act type thing. But it just has fallen apart over and over again.
I had a person that I spoke to yesterday refer to it as a Netflix subscription. Like, you apply, you get renewed, but it's just a lot more expensive.
Yes. I mean, DACA is very expensive for people. I mean, every 2 years you have to pay $495 for your renewal just to the government. And then whatever you're paying, if you're paying an attorney or someone to help you with the renewal. Now, the renewal is not a super complicated process for most people, so that's not extremely expensive. But people are still easily paying. I mean, I guess I don't want to comment on legal fees, but just like people are easily paying somewhere between $500 and $1,000 every time they're renewing this, easily, sometimes more. But I mean, there's just a lot of uncertainty. And yeah, like this program is expensive, obviously, for people to be in and to operate in. And it's also stressful because, I mean, just as an example, like, you know, some people, I mean, you get your permit and you're doing your life. And like, I had a person who contacted me maybe like 2 weeks ago and didn't realize until they work for a major hospital here in Milwaukee, and just didn't realize that her permit was expiring like really soon. Like, she got an email from her employer because she hadn't, you know, saying like, your permit's about to run out. And she like was in a rush, and of course just like, it's extremely stressful. And I mean, you know, it's not an irresponsible thing, because it's like, you're working, you have, you know, in many cases the people have their full lives, and they're, you know, it's just like, as a, you know, if your driver's license expires or your passport expires, these are things that like happen all the time, right? And you might not realize it until you look at it, and you might not look at it. And so like, but for individuals in the DACA program, I mean, you can definitely lose your job, because your employer is really not allowed to keep you employed if you have expired. So it's just like really devastating consequences too, in certain cases. And it's very, you know, it's a lot of hardship really for people in the program too.
Attorney Laura Fernandez, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for your time.
Laura Fernandez is an immigration attorney in Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM's Angelina Mosher-Salazar. Coming up, our Fit for You segment explores the science behind the change in our sleeping patterns during the coronavirus pandemic. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. About a third of our lives is spent sleeping, and sleep is important for our physical, emotional, and mental health. It allows our bodies and brains to recuperate from the day and builds our immune function, something especially important during a pandemic. However, the CDC estimates that 30 to 40% of American adults sleep less than 6 hours a night. Sleep deprivation is often associated with increased risk of anxiety, depression, and our ability to cope with stress. As the pandemic has suddenly changed our lives and schedules, and has added more stress to our daily lives, you may have noticed your sleeping habits change. Whether you're sleeping more, less, or even remembering more dreams, our brains are working overtime, both while we are awake and asleep. To find out more about the science of our change in sleeping patterns, I'm joined by Dr. David Plant, the medical director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. He starts by explaining if sleep differs between men and women.
Fundamentally, men and women sleep similarly. So We all have the same brain, and our brain is really what generates sleep. So our brain actually cycles through these different three stages. There's wakefulness, and then there's two kinds of sleep. There's something called rapid eye movement sleep, or REM sleep, you might have heard of, and also non-rapid eye movement sleep. And men and women both go through these same patterns of sleep very similarly. What's different between men and women is risk for different sleep disorders and sleep problems. So for example, men are at an increased risk compared to women to have a sleep disorder called obstructive sleep apnea. That's a disorder where people have trouble breathing because the back of their throat collapses intermittently during sleep. Whereas women are at higher risk for some other sleep disorders like insomnia and restless leg syndrome compared to men. So insomnia is when you have difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep despite adequate opportunity. And restless leg syndrome is a sleep disorder where you have a very uncomfortable sensation where you feel like you need to move your legs at bedtime, which can interfere with and make it difficult to sleep. So the long and short of it is that men and women sleep very similarly, but they're at risk for different sleep problems over the course of their lives.
When we experience sleep problems, we often think of the effects it just has on us throughout that day, right? We're groggy, we aren't as motivated during work. But what are the larger implications sleep has on things like public health or even societal costs when the population is sleep deprived?
Well, I think that too is a great question and a great way of thinking about things. So we often think about how we are functioning by ourselves in terms of our sleep. So how do we sleep last night? How do I feel today? But the reality is our sleep definitely impacts others. So even before we think about the sort of bigger public health aspects, I like to think about the family even, because right now in the context of COVID-19, a lot of us are spending a lot more time with our families, and our family routines are pretty different. So how each of us sleeps can impact the other person's overall day. So for example, if you have young children at home, how they're sleeping has a pretty profound effect on people's psychological well-being if they're parents. And a lot of times parents may struggle if their children are sleeping because of all kinds of different family dynamics that can play out. So that's kind of on a more sort of local level. And then there's the bigger sort of societal standpoint or public health issues. So actually sleep disorders are really big an underappreciated public health problem, especially in the United States. So probably the biggest problem that we have is insufficient sleep. So the Center for Disease Control estimates that about 30 to 40% of adults in America sleep less than 6 hours per night, which is definitely less than what is typically recommended, which is usually about 8 hours per night. So there's a lot of chronic sleep deprivation in society. And that can lead to a whole host of long-term medical consequences for people. So we know that insufficient sleep is associated with things like increased risk of high blood pressure, increased risk of diabetes and poor glucose metabolism, and a whole host of other things. So there's obviously a public health risk there. And then there's also the risk of increased accidents, either in the workplace or on the road when people are sleep deprived. And that too is a major problem for all of us to think about.
As you mentioned when we first started, there's a lot of barriers to sleep in our current situations as we are all being safer at home and experiencing this pandemic together, either maybe under or oversleeping because there's a lack of schedule. We all have anxiety that is impacting our lives. But it seems that even if we are sleeping during this time, and one main thing that I'm very curious about personally is that maybe it doesn't feel like it's good rest, even if we're getting sleep. And a lot of people are dreaming more, whether it's nightmares or just remembering their dreams. So is there a specific like scientific explanation for how our brains are working during sleep right now that we are noticing changes in sleep patterns versus this is part of my everyday, I hit the bed and I get up and I go again next morning? Now it seems to have a greater lasting impact on how we're feeling and doing.
Well, there's probably a lot of things that are going on, and they may vary from person to person in terms of how their sleep quality is in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. There's some people who are probably saying that they're sleeping just fine and they don't have any specific problems, but for a lot of people, that's not the case. And they have noticed a pretty significant change in, in the quality of their sleep. And they may, people probably notice different things or experience different problems. So as you alluded to, one thing that people are doing now more actually when we look at the data is it seems like people are actually sleeping a bit longer now that they're at home. If they are able to work from home or they may unfortunately be out of work, they may not have something to wake up for early. So they may allow themselves to sleep a bit longer. So the, in some ways you might think, well, that might actually help with the overall qualities of your sleep if you're potentially sleep deprived and now you're getting more. And so some people may feel better, but what a lot of people are noticing is they may start sleeping later and not keep a regular wake time. And so that can lead to a disruption in their routine. And then that can actually make it harder to sleep at night, either difficulty falling asleep, or they may wake up more during the course of the night. There's also just the really big issue of stress and anxiety that's almost universal among folks at this point. And certainly how we feel and our level of stress can pretty significantly impact how we sleep at night and how we perceive the quality of our sleep. So even if we're in bed and we're pretty sure we slept most of the night, we may wake up feeling kind of fatigued or tired. And that could be because the stress during the day causes us to have what we call brief arousals at night. So those are, that's a medical term for sort of a brief wake up of the brain where it comes to alertness. It's oftentimes so short, we may not even be fully aware of it. So that can cause a decrease in the overall quality of sleep at night. And there may also be other sleep disorders that are sort of being brought to light or caused by some of the COVID-19 situation. So an example of that might be someone who has obstructive sleep apnea but didn't know that they had that problem. And what we've learned also is a lot of other patterns that affect sleep have changed. So in the mental health community, we're seeing a big increase in alcohol consumption, either to cope with chronic stress or not, or for other reasons. And we know that alcohol can relax the muscles of the upper airway and increase snoring and the likelihood of having sleep apnea. So that can actually cause people to wake up more, both the alcohol and potentially if they have some other undiagnosed sleep disorder. So there's a whole host of things that could be playing into a decreased quality of sleep that people may be having at this point in time in their lives.
Does dreaming change our sleep structure or quality of sleep?
Well, dreams are really interesting. So, you know, people have been wondering about dreams all the way, basically as long as human history has been recorded, and probably even before that. And we don't really exactly know what dreams are for. And it's actually a debated area in sleep medicine, sleep research about what exactly dreams do. What we do think is that dreams fundamentally probably help consolidate memory to a certain degree and sort of help us, again, process some of our daily activities. We also know that when people are dreaming, that different parts of the brain are active compared to when you're awake. So for example, the parts of your brain that are responsible for vision, so something called the occipital cortex in the back of your head is more active, as are sort of parts of your brain that are involved in emotion regulation. So it's called the limbic system is relatively activated. But other parts of your brain, especially the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of your brain that's just behind your forehead, is sort of offline, relatively speaking, compared to when you're awake. And that's important because that part of your brain, that prefrontal cortex, is really important for helping with sort of reason, judgment, and logical thought. So that's why our dreams can be pretty weird at times and not make a lot of sense. But so we have these dreams and we actually dream many, many times during the course of the night. Most of the time, most of our active dreaming in rapid eye movement or REM sleep. And REM sleep typically occurs in folks every 90 to 120 minutes, you go into a REM cycle that can last a variable amount of time. Usually those REM cycles get longer and longer as the night progresses. So a lot of times you remember having a dream when you wake up from REM sleep. You're much more likely to remember that you were dreaming about something. So we've known that since, you know, the 60s and 70s, they were doing experiments after they discovered REM sleep where they put people in the sleep laboratory. They'd wait to see when they go into REM sleep, and then they'd wake them up to see if they remember their dream. And then they'd also wake them up during other stages of their sleep and find that they didn't remember dreams nearly as well. So a lot of how we think about our dreams and talk about them really relies on how well we remember the dream or have recall of it. So probably with COVID-19, we're not necessarily dreaming more, but we may be remembering a lot more of our dreams. And there's a whole host of reasons that may explain some of that. One of the reasons is we may be sleeping later. So because of the way that REM sleep is structured throughout the course of our nights, where the REM sleep gets longer and longer, if you're just more likely to wake up from REM sleep if you allow yourself to sleep a bit later. Also, we may have more anxiety and have those brief arousals that our brain is just spontaneously generating, and those can occur during REM sleep. So we may be more likely to wake up and remember a dream in that context. And then the other reason that we may remember dreams more, again, may vary from person to person, but some people have what we call trauma-associated dreams or nightmares. And certainly if people have pretty significant traumatic experiences, they are more likely to wake up and have recollection of these more disturbing dreams as well.
With stress-related fatigue being a constant for all of us, whether we're adults or even children are experiencing this, of course, is sleep even more important during a pandemic? You know, children of varying ages, they have naps during the day. But as adults, and if we're at home, we may be tempted to nap during the day because we're just feeling more tired during all of this. Are they very useful to nap more as adults during this time? Or is it best to just try and establish a better sleeping pattern at night?
Well, naps are really interesting. Not all naps are bad, but in general, we tend to recommend trying to avoid naps for a few different reasons. So naps are just when you go to sleep during the day. And usually those naps are relatively short. And sometimes, you know, a brief nap can be very refreshing for certain individuals, as some individuals find absolutely no benefit from naps. They either can't fall asleep or they actually feel like they wake up feeling more groggy. So especially if you're one of those folks who you don't even perceive any noticeable benefit from taking a nap, it's probably best to try to avoid it. Now, most people, when they feel like they might need a nap, it actually occurs in the mid to late afternoon. A lot of people blame that on having a big lunch. And even some cultures have siestas that are planned. So they go home after lunch and they take a nap or they rest. And it turns out that actually the reason for that is pretty tied into our circadian rhythm. There's a little tiny dip in the afternoon that just happens naturally in everyone. So it's a very common experience that people may feel more tired and feel like they may want to take a nap in the afternoon. But then if they stay awake, that usually resolves itself by the early evening hours. Now, getting back to your original question about whether or not people should nap, we generally recommend not napping, largely because what happens is you can really disrupt your sleep at night if you do so. So when we nap, we pay off that sleep debt, that homeostatic sleep drive, which is really important to build up during the course of the day so that we can actually, when we go to sleep at night, pay it off and have relatively consolidated sleep. So if we spend time during the day sleeping, it's oftentimes much harder for us to sleep at night. And especially if you're having problems with insomnia, so difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, daytime napping can be a real problem and exacerbate and perpetuate the problem.
Do you think that this period we're going through of heightened anxiety could lead to long-lasting implications of more people suffering from insomnia or other sleep-related problems? Because I think a lot of people are maybe experiencing these things for the first time.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think that anytime you have a stressor, you're more likely to increase risk for insomnia, anxiety, and depression. And those three things are actually intimately tied to one another. So a lot of times insomnia occurs well before people develop more significant anxiety and depressive problems, or they can co-occur. And then over time, they sort of play off one another, oftentimes in a bit of a vicious cycle. So with so many people under so much stress for a whole number of reasons, the rates of insomnia are certainly going up. So there are surveys that have been done in different countries, and there are a number that are being done right now that have all pretty consistently shown that, you know, during these times, complaints about difficulty falling asleep and staying asleep go up. And I suspect for a number of people, those problems may get better as we move towards a new normal eventually, and some of these issues resolve. But for a number of people, what happens is their insomnia stays even after that acute stressor is long gone. Right now, we're in an unusual situation of a widespread and chronic stressor, which is very challenging, and we don't know how that will all play out, but I suspect people will have a lot of residual insomnia even well after COVID-19 has left us.
So in the meantime, what steps can we take to improve our sleep? And, you know, realistically, how long can it take before we experience some consistent, more positive changes in experiences?
So it's very easy to focus on how poorly you slept on one specific night. But the reality is all of our sleep quality and experience will vary from night to night. And so what you're trying to do is over time, develop better sleep habits and sleep patterns that can sort of improve your overall quality of sleep. So that's the first thing. You know, don't get too fixated on one bad night. You want to look at the longer term. So there's a whole number of things that we recommend to people to try to improve their overall quality of sleep. And then there's a number that are also a little bit more specific to the COVID-19 situation. So when we first started off this interview, I talked about how really COVID-19 has really impacted our daily routines pretty dramatically. And so one of the big problems people are having with their sleep is they're letting themselves get out of their routine very easily. And what we want to try to do to improve the quality of your sleep at night, you also want to have a pretty standard daytime routine during the day that can help you sort of get back to getting into a pattern of living. So trying to keep a regular wake time 7 days per week is very important. Okay, so and then when you wake up, trying to get light exposure. A lot of us are spending a lot of times secluded in our homes, not getting much light. And again, light helps tell our bodies, hey, it's time to be awake and alert. Also doing some of the typical things that we normally do if we're going to work, you know, things like showering, getting dressed, those kinds of things. Those are also important cues for our body about what time of day it is. Keeping even regular eating schedules. We've already talked a little bit about the importance of trying to avoid naps if you're having trouble sleeping at night. Another thing that's very helpful is getting exercise. So vigorous exercise during the day increases something called slow wave sleep at night. So slow wave sleep is sort of the deepest and thought to be most restorative aspects of sleep. We do recommend, though, if you're going to exercise, you don't want to do it too close to bedtime. So usually the best time is sometime during the day or by the late afternoon. And you want to give yourself ideally at least 4 to 6 hours for the most part to kind of wind down before you, after vigorous exercise, before you try to sleep. And then some other things we recommend are kind of common sense to a certain degree, but avoiding too much caffeine, especially late in the day. And then also avoiding alcohol before bed. Because it can both relax the muscles of the upper airway, which we talked about a little bit in the context of sleep apnea, but also alcohol can really disrupt our sleep patterns pretty significantly. So we know that alcohol helps people fall asleep if they drink it right before bed. But it turns out that what happens is after an hour or two, you really sort of end up paying doubly for it. So the alcohol, after it leaves your system, causes your brain to have a lot of arousals during the second half of the night, where the quality of your sleep is quite poor because you drank alcohol before you got into bed. And the other problem with alcohol is it's what we call a diuretic. So it makes you want to urinate. And when that happens, obviously you have to wake up to go to the bathroom, and that can disrupt your sleep as well. So definitely don't recommend people using alcohol as a sleeping medication, because that can get you into a lot of difficulty.
All right. Well, Dr. David Plant, thank you so much for sharing the knowledge and these tips to help us cope and get some better sleep during this time.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. David Plant is the medical director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness and an assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison. He joined me for this month's Fit for You segment, and you can explore past Fit for Yous at wuwm.com. After the break, we learn how touring the city has changed during the pandemic. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As businesses continue to reopen during this pandemic, there are still concerns about how to do it safely. For most places, that has meant limiting the number of people allowed inside at one time, spacing out tables, and taping down socially distanced spots to stand in line. But when your business model depends on going in and out of other businesses, surrounded by a crowd of people, that can be a bit tricky. Anna Lardinoy is the founder of Gothic Milwaukee and Walking Milwaukee, which leads historical ghost tours through the city. She joins Lake Effect Story Powers to talk about the changes she's making to her business model and the forecast for 2020.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a tough question, I think, for any business owner, but how has the pandemic impacted your business so far?
Well, I have to be honest, things have not been good. My last regular day of working was March 13th, which happened to be the Friday the 13th, and I didn't think that that would be my last normal day of business. It was after that weekend that we started to go into quarantine, and from there, I started getting cancellations, which is completely understandable. And at this point, I have almost an entire clear calendar, which is not what I was anticipating for 2020.
Yeah, I mean, the summer is really your time to shine. I mean, of course, fall is a good time for you as well, but...
Absolutely. I was, like many, many small businesses in town that are related to tourism, I was really hoping that the DNC was going to allow me to break into a whole new level of providing service. And it doesn't look like that's going to be the case this year.
Yeah, I didn't even quite think about that. But of course, the DNC is something that would have impacted your business. Now it seems like the DNC is going to be much smaller. It's unclear how it's even going to look in person.
Right. So I'm no longer thinking that I will be able to show guests from out of town the spooktacular side of Milwaukee. But what I am hoping is that local people will want to enjoy a really safe outdoors experience where they can still have a good time in small groups.
How have you adjusted your business model, if at all, to accommodate the needs of this pandemic?
Well, I've adjusted it considerably. So typically, we take about 20 to 25 people on a tour, and it's first come, first serve tour spots. But we're not doing that now. We're making every tour a private tour. So if you are booking a tour with us now, it's only your people who will be on the tour. And we are also limiting it at 8 guests to stay under that 10-person mark that the CDC mentioned would be safer for people. In addition, we're asking all of our guests and our guides to wear masks during the tour. So we'll see smaller tours that are private tours and everyone wearing masks. And I hope that that will give people a feeling of safety and allow people to relax and enjoy the experience without worrying about catching something from someone they don't know or contaminating other people.
So in general, for people who aren't familiar with how you do your tours, can you describe what one generally looks like?
Certainly. So we are haunted historical walking tours, and we meet our guests outside in a public area, usually in Cathedral Square. And then as a group, we walk around the city for about 90 minutes, going to different attractions that are part of Milwaukee's haunted history. So as I'm sure you can imagine, the Pfister Hotel is on our tour because it's Milwaukee's most famously haunted spot. And we also go to a number of landmarks, and they cover about a mile and a half of downtown streets.
Are most of those places still open? Are you allowed to go around those spaces?
Yes, we will not be going into any locations. So our entire tour is now taking place outdoors, nothing indoors. Only a maximum of 8 guests, and everyone will wear masks. So we will always be in a public space with hopefully wind blowing away anything that could possibly be near us.
A lot of what you do is in downtown Milwaukee. How have the protests impacted your ability to do your work?
Well, we have had no interest in tours during the protest. And while that's difficult as a business owner to not be able to work, it's much more important what's happening in Milwaukee now, to have this moment in time where we are living history. And I have to believe that the results of these protests are going to be so much bigger than anything I could have done this season, that it's hard for me to resent it, because it's just so much bigger than Gothic Milwaukee.
Yeah. Well, and that gets to, in some ways, my next question. Of course, so much of what you do involves ghosts, ghost stories. Do you think there are any applicable stories here in the Milwaukee area that relate to the moment we're experiencing right now?
Well, I certainly do think that. And in fact, I used to tell a story about when Milwaukee created a pest house, because we had a very out of control smallpox epidemic in Milwaukee. And it was so bad for a while that people stopped immigrating to Milwaukee for a period. And the city did not react until people stopped coming here for goods and services. And there was a tremendous loss of life due to that. And when people are taken from their life very suddenly, that's usually where you get ghost stories. So I think that there's a lot of parallels between many of the epidemics that we've had in the past and what's happening now. This is not a ghostly story, but the Milwaukee County Historical Society's newsletter in May had an excellent summary of 1918 in Milwaukee and how the flu epidemic spread through and how we handled it. And just reading that, there were so many parallels between that time in history and what's happening now. It actually brought me comfort, because as I was reading that, I was thinking, we've been through this before. It probably felt as hopeless for them as it does for us, and they came out on the other side, and so will we. So I think that there is a lot of hope in those type of stories, because you can see that terrible things have happened and people have lived through them, people who are just like us. And so I find that hopeful.
Yeah. Well, Anna, good luck going into the summer.
Thank you so much. I truly appreciate it. I hope that we'll be back to full capacity in fall, but even if we're not, we're always going to be here to show the spooktacular side of Milwaukee to anyone who wants to join us.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Anna Lardinoy is the founder of Gothic Milwaukee and Walking Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. We'll take one last break and then listen to an essay that pays tribute to comedy legends Jerry Stiller and Fred Willard. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Two comedy legends passed within the same week in May, Jerry Stiller and Fred Willard. Stiller was 92 and Willard was 86 years old. Both of their contributions to comedy in all forms, from stage to television and film, are immeasurable and made them household names. Filmmaker and Wisconsin native Steve Burrows had the pleasure of working with both Stiller and Willard on his film Chump Change, a Miramax show business satire, most of which takes place right here in Wisconsin. Burrows pays tribute to the two comedy legends in this essay.
In show business, the only thing harder than being funny is being consistently funny. It's hard in a 20-minute stand-up routine. It's nearly impossible in a 90-minute film. Now try being funny for 6 decades. I had the incredible luck to work with not one, but two comedy legends, both at the top of their game, at the same time, on the same film. Jerry Stiller and Fred Willard were already known as comedy gods. Together they made audiences laugh for over 100-plus years. Both recently died the very same week. Their scene-stealing credits speak for themselves. Jerry Stiller on The Ed Sullivan Show, Broadway, Hairspray, Seinfeld. Fred Willard on Fernwood Tonight, Roseanne, Modern Family, Best in Show. These guys were seemingly in everything. Most notably, they were laugh-out-loud funny before LOL was LOL. Years ago, I had the opportunity to write and direct my first film, the Miramax showbiz satire, Chump Change. Much of the film takes place in Wisconsin. My producer, Marianne Page, gave me one critical piece of advice. Write funny parts, and the funny people will come. I wrote Chump Change in 5 weeks and hoped to hell that someone would like it. My producer knew Jerry Stiller and his equally gifted wife and comedy partner, Ann Mira, from New York, and she gave them my script. Shockingly, within days, Ann and Jerry both said yes. Ann would play the part of the casting director, and Jerry the head of the movie studio. I couldn't believe it. Stiller and Mira? With this early momentum, I decided to go for broke. I had written the part of the mealy-mouthed manager specifically for Fred Willard, but I never actually thought I'd get Fred Willard. We sent Fred the script, and Fred really liked it, but first he wanted to know who else was in the film. I told him Ann Mira and Jerry Stiller. Fred said yes on the spot. And that's exactly how I scored the rest of my stellar cast. Tim Matheson, Tracy Lords, Clancy Brown, AJ Benza. Who wouldn't want to be in a movie with Jerry Stiller and Fred Willard? I cast every type of actor in Chump Change. Shakespearean, method, improvisational, non-actor actors. As I was a first-time director, it was like juggling chainsaws in quicksand. I would need to rely on the masters. Surprisingly, neither Jerry or Fred were anything like their on-camera personas. Jerry was humble and extremely soft-spoken, the antithesis of the loudmouth Frank Costanza on Seinfeld. Fred Willard was far from the clueless dimwits he always seemed to play. Both were gentle men in the true sense, and very serious about the comedy. However, when it came time to shoot, Fred and Jerry's approach to comedy could not have been more different. Fred Willard didn't want to rehearse. At all. He wanted to go right for it out of the gate. After his first hilarious take, Fred asked me if he could do a take of his own, embellishing on the lines I'd written for him. yes, please. The lines Fred improvised were so deeply funny and so superior to mine that I ended up using every single bit Fred gave me in the film. And Fred gave me all those jokes for free. And I got credit for them. On the other hand, Jerry Stiller wanted to rehearse the script as written. A lot. As we were rehearsing this first scene, things weren't going too well. Jerry had to say the line, "Hello, Milwaukee, this is the Colonel." We kept rehearsing this over and over, and you could barely hear Jerry. "Hello, Milwaukee, this is the Colonel. Hello, Milwaukee, this is the Colonel." The scene was really falling flat, and even worse, it wasn't funny. The crew was getting nervous. As this was my first film, I really had no idea what to do. Then my cameraman, Al Baker, told me that some of these old pros like to save it for when the cameras are rolling. So I said to Jerry, "Hey, Jerry, you want to try one for real?" And Jerry said, "What, we're going to shoot one?" Suddenly, like a switch, Jerry came to life. "Hello, Milwaukee! This is the Colonel!" You can actually hear the crew laughing in that scene. After all these years, Fred and Jerry's outtakes from Chump Change are still making the rounds. As an added bonus, when Ann and Jerry found out just how low our budget was on Chump, they donated their salaries to the film and insisted my producer and I stay at their apartment when we were shooting in NYC. I'm not sure he knows this, but I slept in Ben Stiller's bed for a week. In a dinner for the ages, I was privileged to spend one raucous evening listening to Ann and Jerry tell their unbelievable stories. Like the time when Jerry was going to quit show business and go back to selling live chickens door to door. And then Ed Sullivan called. As we approached the end of our shoot, we still needed one famous person to play the star of the movie in the movie. Ann and Jerry literally handed me their personal Rolodex and said to start looking for names. As I scrolled through their Rolodex, I saw names like Carol O'Connor, who played Archie Bunker, Meryl Streep, Robert De Niro, Robin Williams. It was a who's who of showbiz royalty. Ann told me to pick a name within reason and that she and Jerry would make the call. The next thing you know, I have Abe Vigoda from The Godfather in my movie. So how did the singular Jerry Stiller and the inimitable Fred Willard each succeed for over 60-plus years in a business full of venom and backstabbing, scurrilous reprobates? Well, being drop-dead funny is certainly a mandatory requirement. But in my precious tenure with them both, I believe it was their generosity that made them great. They gave their time, their humanity, the gift of their blood, sweat, and comedy tears, all dedicated to their innate sense of ensemble in their work, making everyone around them personally and professionally better. There is no way that our little independent movie, shot on a shoestring, would ever become a Miramax film without them both. These were men of rare talent and character, and I thank Fred Willard and Jerry Stiller deeply for their unbridled generosity of spirit and for making us all laugh so very, very hard.
Steve Burrows is a filmmaker and Wisconsin native currently living in Los Angeles. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.